Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Joining me on the roundtable this week is Joe Ingles, senior reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Welcome back, Joe.
Great to be here.
That's the enthusiasm I like. Jesse Ballmer, politics and state government reporter at the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome, Jesse.
Thanks for having me.
And Morgan Trowell, Columbus Bureau reporter for News 5 Cleveland. Welcome back, Morgan.
Good morning.
So Intel has agreed to give the U.S. government a 10% stake in its company. It's an unusual move that will make the government one of the company's largest shareholders and perhaps solidify its future in the U.S. and in certain places like maybe Central Ohio. This is the second financial infusion the company received in a week's time, because last week, SoftBank, a Japanese company, also invested $2 billion into Intel. So, Joe, the news of the agreement landed late Friday afternoon between Intel and the U.S. Were you surprised by it?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if I was surprised or not, but there had been hints that that's what they were working toward, trying to get some sort of stake in it. And given what the claim was for getting that stake, which is in exchange for them producing these chips, which Intel is not the major chip maker. You know, that's other companies. So basically the U.S. government is giving money to Intel to do something that it's not really leading the whole industry in to begin with. So I don't know that I was surprised, but I can definitely understand where the reasoning was coming from with that. And there have been other times in history where companies have been asked to step up and do something for the, you know, that benefits the country, and definitely having U.S. chips would benefit the country in one way or another. So,
and Morgan, this was kind of a swift turn of events, because the president, you know, less than 2 weeks ago was calling for Intel CEO Lip-Bu Tan to resign. And then they had this White House meeting, and now everything seems fine.
Yeah, I mean, directly after the meeting, he was posting online about how great that he thinks he is. I think that, you know, with the president's ongoing trade war, he really wants to, you know, promote the U.S. production of these chips. But yeah, I mean, I wasn't fully surprised, but it definitely is a huge deal to have the U.S. government have a 10% stake in a major company. You know, even Bernie Sanders said that this was a good idea. Take what you will from that idea. But this is a really big deal to have this, especially with him, you know, wanting to promote chips in Ohio. But also, we'll see how this impacts the Ohio plant.
And Jesse, I have to imagine the reaction has been positive from Ohio senators John Houston and Bernie Moreno. What has the reaction been like when it comes to thinking about Intel's kind of little marriage we have here in Central Ohio?
Yeah, I think a lot of Ohio politicians are eager for this project to move forward. It's been such a journey, even from it being announced while Mike DeWine was running for re-election, you know, in the 22 cycle. So we've had a lot of ups and downs. We've had a lot of delays. I think there's generally a desire from Ohio's two Republican U.S. senators to get this going. You've seen really kind of a divergence between Senator Bernie Moreno, who was one of the people like really calling for transparency or even divestment from the CEO, versus Senator John Houston, who was much more like, I don't know, let's find out some more, let's get some more information. And Houston really is tied to this a little bit more, because when he was lieutenant governor, that's when this deal was being made. So you're seeing just a little bit of difference in the politics between Ohio's two top leaders on this issue.
Well, and Joe, there's I mean, I can remember President Trump saying that he wanted the CHIPS Act to go away. You know, he mm-hmm. called it like the Chippy Chips Act needs to go away. And that was like a huge thing because Ohio was like, no, we love the CHIPS Act. Don't do that. And now he's getting into the chip business with the United States having a 10% stake.
Sure, because he can be. You said it. He is getting into the chip business. So, you know, anytime he can, you know, get out there and he likes to get involved with these. He loves to make a deal. This is the let's make a deal president. Anytime he can make a deal.
The art of the deal.
The art of the deal. And if it looks good for him, looks good for the American government, then he's all about that.
This is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides, and we're talking with Morgan Trow with News 5 Cleveland, Jesse Ballmert with the Columbus Dispatch, and Joe Ingles with the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Moving on to some election news. The latest news in the 2026 election, yes, it is a year away, but there are big races that are finally starting to take shape. The governor's race as of right now is a matchup between Republican Vivek Ramaswamy and Democrat Dr. Amy Acton. Joe, what do we know about the Democratic Congressman Tim Ryan? What has he said recently about whether he wants to run for governor?
Well, he's continually said he is interested, and he's still saying he's interested. But now his publicist is saying probably he'll make an announcement by September 30th as to whether he wants to jump into the race. For those who may not remember, Tim Ryan ran, what was it, in 22? He came pretty close. Tim Ryan is from the Boardman area. He is, has some labor ties that are pretty strong, and he kind of appeals to those working Ohioans, the Democrats who voted for Trump last time around. Some of them are the people that Ryan appeals to.
Now, Jesse, Amy Acton was on the Reporter Roundtable last week. We interviewed her, and she talked about this possible Tim Ryan candidacy, and she kind of blew it off. She basically said she doesn't have time to worry about hypotheticals, and she wants to be governor. Does that surprise you? That's what she has to say.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable reaction from a person who's been in this race since January. Really, the Democratic side of the Ohio governor's race is interesting because there was this kind of looming cloud of will former Senator Sherrod Brown jump into the U.S. Senate race or jump into the Ohio governor's race. And I think that impacted fundraising, it impacted endorsements for Dr. Acton because people were, if Sherrod was going to get in the governor's race, spoiler alert, he did not. but that was going to determine like whether she was going to get some of this clout and support. So now that Senator Sherrod Brown is now officially trying to return to the U.S. Senate, now Amy Acton is the candidate in this race, and other candidates like perhaps Tim Ryan are mulling their options, trying to decide, do they think they're a stronger candidate on the D side?
Yeah, and Morgan, I asked Amy Acton if she would be Tim Ryan's lieutenant governor or vice versa, if Tim Ryan would be her lieutenant governor. And she basically said, no, thanks on the lieutenant governor part. I'm running for governor.
Yeah, which also is not surprising. I feel like a lot of times people behind the scenes will work for lieutenant governor. Whereas, you know, if you're already in the race, if you're already running for governor, a lot of times it will take a long time. We remember when John Husted was running for governor with Governor Mike DeWine also running, and then eventually had to decide, okay, I do not have the right polling for this. I do not have the right vote. So I am going to concede and be LG and make a deal. With this, yeah, I don't think anybody who's running for governor is going to say, I'll give it up and be LG, especially not with somebody who hasn't officially announced.
Well, let's turn to someone who is running for governor, Vivek Ramaswamy. His campaign is racking in the money and endorsements, including $10 million in donation to his PAC from billionaire financier Jeff. Is it Yaz? Yaz?
Yaz. I believe Yaz. Yaz.
Yeah. Okay. So Jeff. Jeff gave him $10 million. Some of Ramaswamy's comments regarding education are raising concerns among public educators. He spoke last week at an event in Hilliard. It was hosted by the conservative group Americans for Prosperity, and he said he favors merit pay for teachers.
What I'm talking about is pro-teacher may not be pro-teacher union, may not be pro-bureaucracy, local leaders ought to be able to actually run their schools in a manner that brings that application of standards both to our students and to the performance of our teachers, our administrators, our principals, frankly, even our superintendents.
So it's clear education is going to be a central theme for both candidates. This is what Dr. Acton said when she appeared on this show about Ramaswamy's fundraising and about public education.
I know that we're up against a self-funding billionaire and people like Yass, who just gave $10 million to his PAC because he wants to do away with public schools, something I will be fighting for. Public schools saved my life. My husband is an elementary public school teacher for 43 years.
So, Jesse, do you feel education is always a hot topic? Is it going to be central to the governor's race?
Yeah, I think we've already seen from what the candidates are talking about that this is something that they feel they can, make a key issue of their campaign. And it's in a lot of instances, Ohio's children are not meeting the mark as far as mathematics and learning English. And so there is room for improvement in the Buckeye State. But how they're going to go about making that improvement is where we're really going to see the policy differences. Mm-hmm. Vivek Ramaswamy, even from his campaign launch speech, was talking about merit pay for teachers, which is an idea that has been tried, really over a century. And a lot of it comes down to the details, which are what we don't have yet.
And Morgan, besides education, what do you think is going to be the big focus of the governor's race over this next year?
I think healthcare and Medicaid. I think a lot of people in rural areas rely on rural hospitals, and with cuts to Medicaid at both the state and federal level, I think that is going to be something that comes up a lot. We know that Dr. Amy Acton is a doctor. She said that she's going to make that a big part of her campaign. We know that Vivek Ramaswamy, previously his company, dealt with Alzheimer's drugs, which is a whole other story, but we do know from previous comments that healthcare and supporting people in rural areas could be a focus.
And Joe, I don't know if you covered the Vivek Ramaswamy event in Hilliard, but no. From what I've heard is Vivek Ramaswamy does a great job in front of a crowd. Presents himself well, acts like he's not giving a stump speech while he is.
Yeah.
So what do you make of him and the different, for lack of a better word, the different vibe that Dr. Amy Acton has versus him?
Oh, that's night and day, really. Honestly, Vivek Ramaswamy, when I have covered him, he is slick. I mean, he really gets up there and he talks, and it's almost like he's almost like a salesman selling you something, a very slick talker. Amy Acton is much more of a reserved, kind of explaining things. She likes to explain things. If you remember back in COVID, she would take during the COVID days, she would take all of these complicated medical things and she would explain them in terms that people understand. But it would take her some time to do that. She's not big on the slogans and, trying to weave in some kind of, idea into everything she's doing. She likes to take facts and put them out there for people to think about. And it's just two different styles. Vivek Ramaswamy is much more of a showman, like you said. He really does have that show aspect to him. And given that people don't necessarily know him very well, he has the opportunity to define himself to Ohioans. Amy Acton, she's known from COVID days, but maybe not known very well, but she is known, and a lot of people have strong opinions one way or another about her, where they might not have that from Vivek Ramaswamy just because he hasn't been on the scene for as long.
Jesse, do you think Amy Acton will change her style at all? Or do you think that this is her style? Does she need to match Ramaswamy a little bit more?
I think each candidate is going to take their different approach. Neither of these candidates has run statewide in Ohio before, or really run for any race in Ohio before. Mm-hmm. Ramaswamy has the benefit of having run for president in Iowa. He came in fourth, dropped out, and endorsed Donald Trump, so it was kind of a short bid. But he's more used to being in front of a crowd, versus Amy Acton was more used to being in front of a video camera addressing, mm-hmm. you know, reporter questions one after the other. So you're seeing just kind of the difference in their experience when it comes to like addressing a large crowd.
Well, coming up, we're going to talk about President Trump's plan to eliminate mail-in ballots. Plus, we have a new candidate for Ohio Secretary of State. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk about all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. Still with us, we have Jesse Ballmert, politics and state government reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, Morgan Trow, Columbus Bureau reporter for News 5 Cleveland, and Joe Ingles, senior reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Continuing our conversation about the 2026 election, it's not just the governor's race on the ballot. Statewide offices are up for grabs as well. And up until now, Ohio's Democratic Party has not really rolled out very many candidates for these statewide races. But last week, Democratic Representative Allison Russo became the newest candidate running to be the next Secretary of State. The former House Minority Leader has a primary challenger in Dr. Brian Hambley. He's an oncologist from Cincinnati. Allison Russo addressed that in her comments to the press.
I am more interested in us having the strongest possible ticket, and I'm running because I feel that I'm the strongest possible candidate to be in this race.
So, Jesse, what do you make of Russo picking Secretary of State as the office she's pursuing? I mean, when she stepped down from Minority Leader, everyone kind of knew she was going to do something.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty high-profile office, and there are a couple things recently have made it even more high-profile. One, the Ohio Secretary of State is on the Ohio Redistricting Commission, and so that's one of a key vote for if you're going to make any changes to maps or perhaps make them a little, you know, less partisan than they currently are. That's a key vote on that panel. The other thing is there's this group called the Ohio Ballot Board. There's five members on it, and probably people hadn't heard of it until a couple years ago. This group is responsible for writing the language for ballot issues that are going up for a vote of Ohioans, and they made some significant changes to the abortion rights amendment in 23, and then they made some pretty significant changes to the redistricting amendment in 24, so much so that Democrats and some activists say that they really, you know, stopped that issue from passing just with the ballot language alone. And so those are two really important positions. And I think Allison Russo, with experience being on the Ohio Redistricting Board, sees this as a place where she can make a difference.
Yeah, Joe, she'll be running against in the primary Dr. Brian Hambley. I mentioned he's an oncologist. Hambley has been traveling the state for months. He's raised $500,000. Mm-hmm. Did we get any reaction from him to having a challenger?
He welcomed her into the race. He put out a statement saying, "I welcome, an exchange of ideas." But let's face it, you know, Alice Russo is going to be much better funded, and she's going to have backing from a lot of different, you know, unions, teachers unions, you know, all the different constituencies of the Democratic Party. And she will get that. I think the thing that we really need to watch, though, are there were a lot of Democrats who were really hacked off back in the days where They were going through redistricting, and Allison Russo, as the Democratic House member on the board, and also Nikki Antonio as the Senate Minority Leader on the board, both of them kind of said, you know what, we don't like these maps, but we're going to vote for them so the progress can go forward and voters can knock them down next year at the ballot box. Voters didn't knock them down at the ballot box. They didn't change the process. The process is the same. And I think there's still, I still talk to Democrats who never forgot or never forgave that. So I think that's a factor that we need to look at as well.
So, Morgan, it's a positive for Allison Russo that she has experience in redistricting and the ballot board, but then it's a negative because people disagree with her, how she used that role.
Sure. I think that she would be able to make up from that by saying that this was something that she was, for lack of better words, forced to do. Also, I think the Democrats did not expect for issue one to fail in 2024. They thought that they were going to have a whole new commission, as mm-hmm. Joe had mentioned. So I feel like with the amount of money she would receive, with the experience she has, you know, she had a primary challenger when she was running, she flipped a seat. And then, you know, she has a lot of respect from both Democrats and Republicans alike. I feel like she will be fine in terms of that incident. I think that there is a subsect of people who are upset about it, but still will vote Democrat no matter what. And who knows if they will then support, you know, Brian Hambley instead. But she does have experience. She does know the redistricting commission. She does know the ballot board better than somebody who has not been a politician.
Now, you live here and you cover the state house, but you represent Cleveland, mm-hmm. News 5 Cleveland. Do people around the state know Allison Russo?
No. So I have both my Northeast Ohio, so News 5 Cleveland is my home, but I also have WCPO in Cincinnati. I would say that people who are involved in politics definitely know Allison mm-hmm. Russo, but no. A lot of times people don't even know that they have house, like state house representatives. Yeah. A lot of times people will know the governor, but they won't know even who the secretary of state is, or who the treasurer is, or who the auditor is. I think that she will face challenges when it comes to going around the state. I think a lot of Democrats will face challenges. Republicans show up to vote, rural areas show up to vote, Northwest Ohio shows up to vote. So she really will have a challenge in getting to all those areas, but she will have a lot of Democratic support.
Do people in Cincinnati know who Brian Hambley is?
I mean, I'm sure his patients do. It all depends on going out, meeting voters, having town halls, talking to people, going door to door. It's a tough task mm-hmm. to campaign, especially statewide, especially with not having the same amount of money that the Republican PACs and the Republican lobby has. Democrats are up against a challenge in the state when it comes to statewide positions. And, you know, I'm sure each of them will run the best campaigns that they can. And good luck to them.
Yeah. And Jesse, there are other statewide offices. Republicans have declared in each of them, but are we expecting some more Democratic names to come out here in the next few weeks?
Yeah, I think so many people were waiting to see what former Senator Sherrod Brown was going to do. And I think having him on the ticket gives Democrats a little bit more hope that there's going to be some strength, there's going to be some money coming into the state. And so if you're weighing whether to get in or not get in, I think you're more likely to get in at this point.
Well, and I just played that game with Morgan where I'm like, do people know who these people are? But do people know who, you know, because right now we're doing like musical chairs of statewide offices. So do they know who their treasurer is right now, who is now going to run for Secretary of State, right? That kind of thing.
Not necessarily, but I say more and more, you know, they say all politics is local. It's becoming all politics is federal. So if you're a Republican, if you are supported by President Donald Trump, you're going to have the money, the resources, and kind of just that seal of approval that's going to help in a state like Ohio that is increasingly red.
Frank LaRose is the current Secretary of State, and is he running for
Auditor.
Okay. And then Robert Sprague is the current treasurer. He's running for Secretary of State.
Correct.
What else am I missing? Who's running for Attorney General?
Keith Faber, who's the current auditor.
Sure. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, we're playing a bit of musical chairs here, but you can do that when you have statewide experience, you have that kind of fundraising base, and you're looking for another job because you're term limited.
And this is where the power of the slate card comes in. Those cards, you know, you think, oh, they don't really amount to much, but I have seen people over and over carrying slate cards in when they go to vote, just to know who these down ticket people are, who they should vote for. And they'll vote, you know, obviously, it matters to them whether they're Republican, Democrat, and they often vote straight ticket.
This is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides. We are talking with Joe Ingles with the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Jesse Ballmert from the Columbus Dispatch, and Morgan Trow with News 5 Cleveland. President Trump wants to end mail-in ballots. Over the years, mail-in voting has been used more on the Democratic side, but in recent years, especially since the pandemic, more and more Republicans are mailing in their votes as well. In fact, that's how thousands of Ohioans who are Republican voted President Trump into office the second time. So, Morgan, what is the reason President Trump is giving that he wants to end mail-in voting?
I want to be very, very clear. There is no widespread evidence of voter fraud across the country in Ohio. I want to be very clear when I say this before I say what the president has said. President says that mail-in ballots are corrupt and that he doesn't believe in them. He also has said that he wants to get rid of tabulators, which let us know who won the results on election night. Secretary of State, Republican Secretary of State Frank LaRose, has continuously said that these are good things and that we have there's very, very, very low voter fraud. But the president has continued to, since 2020, has said that he believes that people are falsely voting or that these are scams. There is no evidence of that. But it's just another rhetoric and talking point.
Joe, does the president have the authority to get rid of mail-in voting in Ohio?
That's a big question. But, you know,
Morgan says no.
Yeah, I don't think but, you know, it's all what the court says, you know. And let's face it, the court might not, you know, it might not go up to the court. The court might not play it out the same way that we think that they would. I think, you know, the bigger thing we have to look at is look at that history of mail-in voting in Ohio. Prior to 2004, the only people who could vote mail-in were people who could justify a reason why they had to vote mail-in. Maybe they were going to be gone. Maybe they were infirmed, whatever it is. Then, you know, after 2004, and if you remember, that election was chaotic because there were students who were standing in line to vote at 4 a.m. over in Gambier because they couldn't get in. The lines were so long and they couldn't get in to vote. Our votes were completely tied up for days in that election. And so after that, that's when they came in and they made this change so that basically any Ohioan who wants to vote mail-in can vote mail-in. So now that we're looking at, you know, this pushback on mail-in voting, it's important to remember how it got there to begin with.
Yeah, Morgan, what did you want to add?
So the president does not have the power to do this. This would be, at best, Congress being able to do this, but the state controls how we vote, and it controls the types of ways that we can vote. So as of right now, even if, you know, the president does make an executive order, there is no legal legitimacy for him to be able to do this. It would have to get pushed to Congress, and then it would have to go to the states. Obviously, with the president's backing, that could be something that pushes Secretary of State Frank LaRose to do something with the legislature. But as of right now, this is more talking points than anything else. I also will add that the people in the military vote mail-in. People who have disabilities vote mail-in. People who are elderly. I did a whole analysis of who votes mail-in, and it is the vast, vast majority is 65 plus. And also, there's way more Republicans that vote mail-in in the 2024 election than registered Democrats.
And Frank LaRose has spent a lot of time being very proud of his elections, right? Like, very proud of how well it went, how secure they were. So he, I mean, at its heart, if he changes it, then he's like admitting something was wrong.
Yeah, he has touted Ohio as the gold standard of elections. And obviously, we know that they have been trying to put forward more types of restrictions. When Republicans put forward types of restrictions or additional regulations, they say it's because they want it to be even more safe than it already is.
Yeah, I was talking last week, Amy, with a state representative, a Republican state representative, who said that they're expecting the federal government to come out with kind of a review of how mail-in voting went in the 2024 election. And based on that, she's ready to go ahead and try to introduce a bill to address some of the changes that may be necessary as she sees them. So, you know, the thing is, the legislature is poised to kind of make those changes quickly if they need to do that. And we've seen that President Trump has a tremendous amount of sway with the legislature. So I think, you know, when we're talking about that, we need to keep in mind that there's more to it. There's also, you know, we're going to have a system where they have to jump quickly. So there won't be a lot of time for the other side to get in there, debate, really produce, you know, a lot of, if you have to change elections, you have to change them quickly. And next year's the election year. So,
well, I wanted to move on before we run out of time in this segment to redistricting. We mentioned it before. Ohio's Democratic chair, Kathleen Clyde, said last week that Texas may be the first redistricting saga, but Ohio is next. And for Democrats, it's been a bitter process. Here's a part of what she said.
Ohioans have watched over and over as Republicans have gerrymandered our state to hell and lied about it.
So, Jesse, what has Clyde said about the tactics that the Democrats used in Texas? And how does she think Ohio Democrats will get involved in this redistricting process? I mean, are we going to have Ohioans fleeing to Chicago?
Yeah, I would be surprised if Ohioans were like going to be Ohio Democrats were getting on a bus and going to another state, in part because the way the process works out, you need a certain amount, a number of Democratic votes until November, at which point you need no Democratic votes to pass a congressional map. But I think Chair Clyde and Democrats across the nation know that Ohio is going to be a tough place because they really just don't have that many cards to play. Republicans control the Ohio legislature, which is where this process starts. They control the majority of the Ohio Redistricting Commission. They also have 6 out of 7 seats on the Ohio Supreme Court, which is the body that will determine whether or not this map meets the anti-gerrymandering rules that voters approved in 2018. And so the options that Democrats have at their disposal are, A, try to make a deal that's going to be better than the worst case scenario, which I think is going to come with a lot of pushback. You could try to put this up for a referendum, because if it passes as a bill, you have 90 days to gather the signatures and put it up to a vote of the of Ohioans. That's something that could delay the map and maybe keep the 10-5 map for a little bit longer. You could try to pass entirely new redistricting reform. That seems like a really stretch. Or you could file a lawsuit. You know, you could challenge it with the Ohio Supreme Court, or if you start getting the Voting Rights Act involved, like if there's some sort of race-based gerrymandering, that can be handled by a federal court that might be more favorable to Democrats. But these are like not your best case scenario options for the Dems.
When you call it a 10-5 map, do you mean there's 10 Republicans in Congress and 5 Democrats? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. So Ohio's current map has 15 congressional districts. There are 10 Republicans and 5 Democrats. Mm-hmm. And really across the nation, both Democrats and Republicans are trying to pick up seats going into the 26 elections. And Ohio could be a place where they try to pick up 2, or if they're being really aggressive, 3 seats.
And this is, they're just redrawing the congressional maps, right? Are the state maps staying the same?
Yeah, so the state maps are staying the same because of what Joe mentioned earlier. There was a bipartisan compromise on the state legislative maps, which will last through the 2030 elections.
2030? Okay. So Intel will be open by the time those maps have to be changed, right?
No,
sure. I jest at Intel. Okay. So Joe, what is the timeline for everything that Jesse was just talking about with the congressional maps? When are we going to see our first draft?
Well, we should be seeing something coming out soon because they have to get this done. You know, you got to have it in place for the primaries next year. So, you know, we should be seeing something in the next couple of months. But I don't think a date has been set yet to introduce anything.
And have we heard since Kathleen Clyde, the Ohio Democratic chair, made those comments? Have we heard anything from the Republican Party chair? Did they respond?
Yeah, so I reached out to the Ohio GOP chair, Alex Triantafilou, who said that they're going to run.
I was going to make you say his last name. I'm sorry. I was like, how do you say it?
Triantafilou.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, he was formerly Hamilton County GOP's chair, so I have a little bit of history and experience
practicing his name.
Yes. Yeah, so reached out to him, and he said that they're going to run a bipartisan process that Ohioans can feel good about. So we'll see.
Okay. Before we take our break, I did want to talk about the Ohio Supreme Court race a little bit, because you mentioned it a few minutes ago. The crowded race for the open seat got a little, or it's not an open seat. The crowded race got a little less crowded because Republican Justice Pat Fisher dropped his bid to challenge his Democratic colleague, Jennifer Bruner. So, Joe, can you catch us up here? This was a crowded race where Pat Fisher, who is a sitting justice, was going to move to a different seat to challenge Jennifer Bruner, the only statewide office holder who's a Democrat. And then, what, like six other people also jumped in?
Yeah, there's a bunch of people in it, and I really have Karen has been covering this more than I have. So but there's a bunch of people who are involved in it. And with Pat Fisher dropping out, it makes it a little bit easier for Jennifer Bruner. But, you know, we're still early in this whole thing, and we don't know how it's going to play out. I think there is definitely a move, though, because Jennifer Bruner is the only Democrat on the Ohio Supreme Court. And there's a definitely a move to try to get her out of there.
And have you been covering this very crowded Supreme Court race at all, Jesse?
Yeah, this move is interesting because Justice Fisher was trying to move to a different seat in order to get more years of service. In Ohio, there is an age limit for judges, which Pat Fisher was going to come up against if he didn't switch seats. So this just means he'll serve out the remainder of his term, and that will be the end of that. And I think that that effort to switch to a different race to try to get more years of service really rankled some of the fellow Republicans who are interested in this seat, and that the Ohio Republican Party had like a screening panel to decide who they want to recommend for this seat, and they picked a Judge Ron Lewis over Justice Fisher. Fisher said that he promised to drop out if he didn't get this support. And so that's what we were seeing last week.
Yeah.
But, you know, this worked last time around, because if you remember the last Supreme Court races, we had Justice Joe Dieters, who had been appointed to a term that was less than a full term. And he went up against one of the Democratic Supreme Court justices, and justices, and knocked her off, giving that larger majority to the Republicans. So they've seen this in practice once. It worked. And so there is a precedent for doing that if they wanted to.
So the Republican Party did endorse one of the remaining five or six, right? Or
this screening panel did. There's going to be a vote of the entire Ohio GOP later.
Yes. Okay. So, but as of right now, instead of being six people running against each other for the primary, maybe now there's five or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, we shall see. We've certainly seen the Ohio Republican Party's endorsement clear the field previously. Notably, Vivek Ramaswamy won it over Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost. Dave Yost took a few days to consider it and dropped out of that primary. And so it is powerful. It is, obviously, we talked about the slate cards, but also you get access to resources. And it's just, it's hard to run against the endorsement in a primary.
But everybody wants to be Supreme Court justice, so there's lots. All right. Well, coming up, we are going to be talking about Governor DeWine getting some pushback for sending Ohio National Guard troops to D.C. That is when All Sides and the Reporter Roundtable continues on 89.7 NPR News. We'll be right back.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides in the Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Still with us, we have Jesse Ballmer, politics and state government reporter with the Columbus Dispatch, Joe Ingles, bureau chief, or not bureau chief, you're not the bureau chief. Joe Ingles is a senior reporter at the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and Morgan Trow is Columbus bureau reporter for News 5 Cleveland. Governor DeWine last week was one of six Republican governors to call up National Guard members and send them to Washington, D.C. And he's gotten some pushback and some flack for it. Joe, what's everyone unhappy about here?
Well, I think a lot of people are unhappy about the whole idea of sending the National Guard in to a city or another state and having them police areas that are questionable. I mean, you know, some people say the areas that the National Guard have gone to in D.C. are not areas where the crime is. And there's, you know, in this day and age, always a theory about why things are being done. So a lot of people think that this is maybe to silence voices of protesters, to, kind of lay the land so that it can be done, you know, nationwide and maybe somehow suppress votes in the future, that kind of thing.
Jesse, what has DeWine said in response? Why did he do this?
Yeah, so Governor DeWine said that this is consistent with other deployments that he has issued over the years. Examples being the Ohio National Guard has responded when mayors in Cleveland and Columbus wanted support after the George Floyd murder in Minneapolis and kind of the response to that. Also, the National Guard has been sent in response to hurricane relief and was also controversially sent to the southern border previously. And so I think he got this request from the Secretary of the Army to assist the D.C. National Guard and said, Ohio will be there.
Hmm. And Morgan, do we know how long they're committed for? Did DeWine put a time limit on it?
So this deployment is just for 30 days. However, when I've talked with his team, they said that if the president requests an extension, they will grant it.
All right. Well, we'll have to wait those 30 days. I don't know when it started, so sometime next month. Joe, I wanted to move on. You had a story about a measure in the state budget that relates to silencers on guns. Actually, what did you learn?
Yeah, actually, it was in the Big Beautiful Bill.
Oh, okay.
It came out. Okay. It's a federal thing.
Federal.
But it basically right now, if you buy a silencer, that's the thing that makes it so that you can hardly hear when a shot is fired from a gun. That's the suppressors are, you pay a $200 tax. And this thing in the Big Beautiful Bill of President Trump's would make it so that you're not paying that $200 tax, and that's waived now.
Okay. And then another story that I wanted to touch on before we ran out of time was, Morgan, you wrote about why some Republican lawmakers are pushing legislation that would legalize raw milk. So is law milk raw? That's hard to say. Raw milk currently outlawed.
Yeah, so raw milk is unpasteurized. So right now there are a couple ways that people can get it in Ohio. One is if you have a herd share. So that means you are sort of buying a percentage of a cow. You're able to go to the farm and get raw milk and raw product. The other is if you are buying it for pets. Quote unquote, pets. So a lot of times we see that people are drinking that and using that as a way for human consumption. So right now, lawmakers have put forward a bill that would regulate and legalize raw milk for farm to consumer, so not in grocery stores. So what this would do would allow them, with some kind of testing guidelines, to be able to sell raw milk. The lawmaker who is proposing it, Kelly Dieter, said that, you know, people are already doing this anyway. We should put some regulations on it. One of the regulations is a liability waiver, and the other one is having it tested for like foodborne bacteria every 30 days. If you know anything about raw milk,
I know nothing about raw milk.
Well, raw milk, I will tell you. Let's debrief. So raw milk, it can grow bacteria very quickly. So pasteurizing is what makes it safe for consumption. Some people, obviously, on the other side of the aisle, this is what Democrats say, that it's safe for consumption. This is what health experts say. Some people who are pro-raw milk will say that, you know, this is better for you because it doesn't have all of the quote-unquote chemicals that are used in pasteurization. With this, it would regulate it, but I talked with doctors about this. They say that the reason why we pasteurize is so that people don't get sick, so they don't die from bacteria, because even if you're testing it once a month, it can grow bacteria the next day. Mm-hmm. So really, it's about the safety of this, but also people say it's about choice. And if they want to drink raw milk, and if they want to get sick, then that's their choice. Or if they want to drink raw milk because they don't trust Big Milk, then that is, you know, that's their prerogative.
Big Milk was a very important part of my childhood, that Got Milk campaign. I mean, you know, Big Milk is everywhere. So is this connected to Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s Make America Healthy Again movement? Does he like raw milk? Where did this come from?
So, yes. So raw milk has gained in popularity a lot over the past decade, but especially since COVID, when people started being more skeptical of the CDC and vaccines kind of became more mainstream. There's always been a group of people in rural areas, especially, that don't trust what's going on with the government or with, you know, the scientific research that is put out by the CDC or the NIH or anything like that. So when it comes to Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and his Make America Healthy Again, he has pushed this, and it wasn't the reason for putting forward the bill, but it definitely played into the interest that Dieter had in this and moving forward.
Do you think anything will come of it, or is it just one of those bills where someone puts their name on a bill and then they'll get some press and then it'll go away?
Well, I think that so this bill does have guardrails, and it does say that it will regulate something that's already happening. But knowing everything that we know about Speaker Matt Huffman and how he has sort of been on the opposite side of the anti-vaccine movement, and he has not been supportive of efforts to, you know, loosen standards or push bills like requiring ivermectin, things like that, it's unclear what he will do or what his leadership will do.
Okay. And Joe, speaking of putting your name on a bill to get some publicity and traction, did you have a story this morning about Buckeyes?
Did I
hear that this morning? Do we have a bill about candy?
Yes, we do. We have a bill about candy. State Senator Bill DeMora is sponsoring a bill that would make the chocolate peanut butter candies that look like Buckeyes, look like the Buckeye nut, it would make that the official candy of the state of Ohio. He says it's from the state tree, which is a Buckeye tree. He says he has bipartisan support. Yeah, I know everyone's just waiting to get that one passed, right?
Right. Well, you added at the end of your story that he knows there's more important things out there, but he said, why not? Right?
Yeah, he said, why not? Because this brings people together and gives something other than, you know, the heavy stuff that they're dealing with down there. So,
all right. Well, and then, Jesse, we have about 3 minutes left, and I completely forgot to ask you about an Emerson poll that came out, because we've talked about things that were in the poll twice, and it keeps slipping my mind. So a poll came out recently. There was a part of the poll that did it ask people about this Ohio National Guard troops thing going to D.C.?
Yeah, the Emerson polling was really interesting because they touched on a variety of issues. One was, should DeWine have sent the National Guard to Washington, D.C.? And it was very divided, which I think we saw in the response to the governor's decision. I know there was a news conference last week with groups from like ACLU and so forth that were concerned that this would start a slippery slope, that if you're going to send troops to D.C., then maybe you're going to start sending them to Ohio cities or Chicago, some other place next. So there was concern about that. Other things that I found generally interesting was Vivek Ramaswamy was leading both of his Democratic challengers.
Both meaning they proposed Amy Acton and then said, what if Tim Ryan?
Obviously, mm-hmm. Amy Acton is the only actual challenger right
yeah.
now.
Okay.
We live in hypotheticals.
Got it. But he led in both, yeah.
So that was interesting. And it had John Husted up on Sherrod Brown, who had just recently announced his U.S. Senate bid.
Okay. Can I make one thing that I found in that poll just absolutely astounding, for at least for me? You know, in Buckeye football nation, whatever we call it these days, it seems like you know way too much about the Buckeyes. But that poll showed that 51% of Ohioans who responded said they had never heard of former OSU football coach and now Lieutenant Governor Jim Tressel. I thought that
what?
Was, yes, 51%.
Who did they poll? Did they poll
That's
Ohio?
That's what I want to know.
They polled in relation to the governor's race, I believe, and it was kind of either don't know enough about or have never heard of the person. And I
so maybe it's don't know enough about.
They don't know his political positions, which I think is more than fair. But I believe in the brand of the Buckeyes.
Yeah, that is surprising. We'll end on that surprising note. Thank you to Joe Engel, senior reporter for Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks, Joe.
Thanks.
Jesse Ballmert, politics and state government reporter at the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks, Jesse.
Go Bucks, beat Texas.
And Morgan Trow, Columbus Bureau reporter for News 5 Cleveland. Thanks, Morgan. This has been All Sides and the Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News.